The project for these 3 days that have been going on is a continuum following that pattern. The Crossings Community is a group of folks in St. Louis who does workshops around the country to link people's Christian faith in the Word of God to their worlds of work. We do three steps to our process. It's about as complicated as a Sunday morning sermon. Namely, tracking people's lives, in this case their world of work, getting a fix on it, that's what this brown meat paper reports are on the wall. Grounding ourselves in the Word of God, and for this one we just took last Sunday's second lesson, 2 Corinthians chapter 4. We took the whole chapter, not just the chunk that was there. And the payoff then is crossing to make connections. If you didn't do one of these brown sheets and want to try, go right ahead. The brown paper is here, and here's some magic markers. Just wheedle your way up.
Ed, do they send out facilitators or group leaders to various places around the country to do these workshops?
Is it we? On the two back tables is propaganda. I'll just tell you what's there and you can pick it up afterwards.
All right.
Number one is this sheet which describes the Crossings Congregational Workshops. This is done as an AELC church publication that did one on. Also on the back table are the things we think we've learned in the last 10 years that we've been doing this, and that's this statement of 15 statements about lay ministry, lay theology. Also on the back table is a report of one of the weekend workshops we did just 2 months ago in Silicon Valley, Cupertino, with an American Lutheran Church congregation, most of whom were in the computer-related industries, but not all of them. One of the persons was a newspaper columnist, and here's the story he wrote of our weekend workshop in Silicon Valley. There's copies of that back there if you want it. Also back there is something that we could look at tomorrow, even though we're not scheduled to do this. I'll tell you a minute about that. And that is a two-pager by Robert Bella, Episcopalian sociology of religion prof, sort of Mr. Big in American sociology of religion, Cal Berkeley, I think, on work as a calling, economics and the theology of work. Okay, that's all on the table right straight back in the middle. The Crossings Community also runs a school in St. Louis. Full-fledged, semester-long courses, credits, assignments, readings, blah, 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 all that. And for that, on the other table, if you're interested, is this cream-colored brochure that says Crossings, and this bluish-greenish piece of paper that describes what we're doing this fall. Now, Fortin just disappeared because, what's your name?
Ed.
Huh?
Ed.
Well, my name's Ed. You can't be all bad. Of course, an awful lot of this, Ed, is bad, so maybe you're... If you're tracking yourself, these are the quickies. Your name, where you come from, which congregation, where you work, and then these last three especially. My work is to, I didn't put in the verbs of what you actually do, write papers, change diapers, organize labor, run a revolution, whatever you do. The best thing about my work is... Just say what it is, the worst thing about my work. That's what we've got on the board. Okay, today's task then is... No, excuse me, I said there might be something tomorrow. A couple of you have asked me for possible more time to do something other than the scheduled time. And this is not official. I don't know if you should tell Elmer. But I'll be sitting over here or standing or walking tomorrow afternoon from 2 to 4, which is known as craft activities. And if you all want to come and either continue what we didn't get done here, or if a few come and nobody's got anything particular, I would go through this one with you just to sit and talk and rap about this work as a calling. So tomorrow afternoon from 2 to 4, unofficial, unscheduled, but available if you want. To sit over here and more talk on this, maybe even just crossing you yourself if that doesn't happen today, or to move into this, work as a calling. Bob Bella's thesis is that work in America, it's very tough to have a sense of calling in work in America today. Many people only have a job. and job means a place where I go to do something for which I get paid, but the work itself is relatively meaningless. I don't get any fun out of the work. The work itself doesn't have any value for me, but I do get paid for it, and with the money I get paid for, that I can, you know, do something valuable. Welfare, home, I mean, you know, food, drink, clothing, family, blah, blah, blah. Lots of folks in America don't have calling, but still do have career, except those lots are upper echelon folks. Now, the poor hardly have any sense of career, because career means that I am moving toward a particular future that goes uphill. Uphill in terms of financial remuneration, uphill in terms of value and worth and position and status and blah, blah, blah. Both of these two, says Bell, now here I'm doing what I do want to do. Come back tomorrow and get the rest of it.
Is it impossible to do that from 3 to 5 so people who have to work till 4 can get in on at least half of it?
What goes on from 3 to 5? 3 to 5 is in other classes again.
4 o'clock is a class, yeah.
Okay, I'll sleep till 3. I'll just shift it. 3 to 5 tomorrow afternoon. Does that put a different crunch on somebody who couldn't come at all? Who is even just casually interested in doing that tomorrow? Coming for another rap session sometime in the afternoon, even though it's not scheduled. Okay, that's a dozen or so. Good. Is 3 to 5 better? Everybody could come sometime from 3 to 5. Okay, let's push it then. 3 to 5 tomorrow. Am I free 3 to 5 tomorrow? I'll just make myself.
We're not going to have a 10:45.
I'm not free, but I'm reasonable.
Yeah. We're not going to have a 10:45.
No, 10:45 tomorrow, I'm doing something else.
Okay.
Which y'all ought to come to. It's very important, but I won't PR that. Okay. Pick up, make up, loose end, whatever, rap session tomorrow afternoon, 3 to 5, or however long people are interested, or before I fall asleep. Okay, the task is...
Now, where did Fortine go?
The task is to make crossing. If half of you people weren't here yesterday to do the brown sheets, I hesitate to ask, but I will, how many people were not here the day before to do the biblical study? 3, 4, 5 of you. Well, that's probably enough that it'd be worth. Let's waltz through that once. I've changed the sheets. Finally changed the sheets. I've now got white paper because I see how much more legible it is. You know, with magic marker on white is easier to read than magic marker on brown. And I found the two last sheets of newsprint in Holden Village. If any of you have connection with the Weyerhaeuser company, would you please get us some newsprint? Ship it in by helicopter, whatever. The biblical text we worked at was 2 Corinthians 4. So would you pop a Bible open, and just to recoup for ourselves, those of us who did it, it was 48 hours ago, and to give the brand new folks a chance at least to catch up with that. This was the actual second lesson for last Sunday, the last 6 verses. The previous Sunday had these 6 verses, 7 verses, and I said, well, as long as we're gonna do the whole thing, let's just pick up the whole business. I'll tell you, though, especially the newcomers, here's what we did on Monday. We said, let's study this Bible text, not just saying what's its meaning for us, but ask 2 questions. What is the human problem that St. Paul, who wrote that, is analyzing and diagnosing in the Corinthian folks' life, as far as we can deduce that? You know, all we've got is what he says. We don't have any of the letters they wrote to him. We don't have any. What do you need?
Pen.
A big one or a little? Okay, don't underline your Bible, let alone our Bible. That'll make it dark and hard to read.
Blacky outs are funny.
That's right. You've heard of red letter edition? She's got blacked out edition.
Expert
day. That's right. Be sober, be... No. Oh, be vigilant. Here's what we found. I'll give it to you once over lightly, and then we'll just read it through to see if you think the biblical text supports that somewhat. We found that as Paul diagnoses the Corinthians, some of his very words, understandably, are signals and keys to what it is. He starts out by saying, I don't lose heart. If you read the context, specifically the previous 3 chapters, you notice that the Corinthians had been losing an awful lot of heart about Paul, because he didn't have the credentials and he, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So Paul says, even though you guys have been putting me down, I don't lose heart about this ministry. But what that reveals, he says, is not just that I've got a problem, you guys putting me down, but you guys got a problem that somehow my ministry seems to you to be so low-key, low-class, not very hot-shot whiz kid at all. In other words, that I start looking like a loser to you. And nobody likes a loser. So it's you don't like me, and the extent to which you find yourself being a loser, some of that's probably just personal reflection and projection too. Nobody likes a loser. And even hints that sometimes some of you folks have undergone the same afflictions that I have. And afflictions are not, you know, upbeat things. Afflictions are downers in the normal way that people experience them. So Paul says, okay, let's just pick it up there. Losing heart, being a loser, worried about being a loser. Burnout is close to this. At least that's a, it could be a phase of, it could be an aspect of that, a 20th century term for that. Being a loser, and then even just losing my spirit about this loser job I got, or this loser marriage I've got, or this whatever. But Paul says, you know, it's even worse than that. That's bad enough. But, you know, if you've got a good psychologist or psychiatrist or maybe just a good support group, you might be able to cope with that just with that. You wouldn't need Jesus. At least you surely wouldn't need his crucified and risen Messiah. That, by the way, is sort of the touchstone for this diagnosis. To keep pushing, or at least squeezing the text again to say, is the problem bad enough or so bad that you'd have to have somebody die and rise for you in order to solve it? Mm-hmm. Or as one of our crossing students, St. Louis, says, ah, I finally catch on to this crazy crossings method. You push the diagnosis until you get a God-sized problem. And then a problem that it would take nothing less than a crucified and risen Messiah to plug that hole, or a God-sized hole. Well, Paul does that. He says, you know, that may look just sort of like sociological, psychological analysis, and it is true, but it's more than that. You guys and gals are being blinded by the God of this world, and even says you become unbelievers in the gospel. Remember, he's diagnosing Christians. It's not pagans. And so he says, Christians have this problem. I know you do. Sometimes I got it too. And I bet the folks sitting here Wednesday morning at Holden have got it too. Christ people, but Christ people afflicted, conflicted, perplexed, problemed. And we spent some time Monday just tracking out what the God of this world today would say. Well, for example, that's a statement from the God of this world, that nobody likes a loser. Or that success with dollar signs is, you know, is the way to go. Or that you count when you make it. Or that, you know, we fill in the blanks for yourself.
Is that going to be a capital God?
What difference does that make?
The small God of the world could be money, could be prestige. Could be, the large God is the God that we see out here in Holden and in our life.
Well, in Greek there are no capitals. So we don't know what Paul meant.
He obviously means the non...
He is not talking about the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Trinitarian partner of Christian worship and faith and dialogue and trust. The God of this world. Who runs this world? The old eon, the old age, sometimes called the devil. Paul just calls him the God of this world. But God in the... I'm sure that... I'm confident that Paul seldom picks words by accident. That in this case, God, a God, any God, is always a trust object. Some of you may remember, if you ever read Martin Luther's large catechism, that he said in this first commandment, thou shalt have no other gods before me. He says, what is a God, any God? And he says, a God, any God, is an object of trust, in Luther's language, on which you hang your heart. It's a very winsome metaphor. And whatever you hang your heart on, that is your functional deity. Regardless of what you confess with your mouth or what you say on a Sunday morning, but whatever you're really hanging your heart on, that's your operational deity. And all of us have, you know, half a dozen going for us at different times. Christians, too. And that's why Paul is sympathetic as well as empathetic here. He's not really creaming him and chewing him out for this, but he's saying, this is serious business, folks. On this Cupertino, Silicon Valley, write-up, feature article, the little plug in there, maybe you can even see it. Workaholism is the male equivalent of anorexia nervosa. Now, after we had myocardial infarction yesterday, I thought maybe we could have anorexia nervosa here today. In both of those cases, what's his name? Nick Arnett is referring to two gods of this world. the god of the American world for women is you've got to be thin. Fat is a no-no. Even plump is. And the anorexia nervosa syndrome, which is kind of unique in Western culture, at least I haven't heard of any other culture that's bugged by people starving themselves to death because they think they're too fat. But the god of this world has told you that. And for the most part, I guess women, I don't know, do men get anorexia nervosa?
Yeah,
but this one says workaholism, because there the god of this world says, your life is what your work is. And if you make it in your work, then you make it. And if you're a loser in your work, you're a loser. And so workaholism is a crazy, literally, I shouldn't say affliction, it's a deity. Where the deity possesses the person. And it's not that the person says, well, you know, I'm hanging on to this god, but I could let go. If you hang on to any deity long enough, you can't let go because the deity's got hold of you. And that's why the biblical word demonic possession is not a metaphor of some ancient world crazy idea about, you know, horned critters. But literally possession is that the god finally has a hold of me and I can't break loose. I need to have an invader from the outside. Last Sunday's gospel said that. That if a strong man has got all his stuff under control and you want to get it, if Satan has got a whole heck of a lot of the turf under his control and Jesus wants to plunder him, that's going to be a big job, because he can't just call out and say, hey, you guys, you're on my side. Remember, come on out. Because they aren't on your side anymore. They're stuck. And so he has to, in that little metaphor, parable, in Last Sunday's Gospel, and Jesus has to some find ways to bind Satan so that he can then get the people that Satan's got his possession on and repossess them. Well, we're not doing Mark chapter 3. So let's go back to this one. Blinded by the god of this world is pretty bad, but it's even worse than that. Because if that line keeps going, he says they wind up perishing. And perishing in biblical language is not just, you know, being a failure in your job or a failure in your marriage. That's being a failure in terms of God's project for you. And that means being eternally dead, finally, at the end of the line, if it just keeps on going that way. Or as I put, being a big loser, losing everything. The good news,
that's the bad news.
That's the bad news. You can tell. Gee, if you can't tell, we better go back to square one. You thought that was the good news. What, you know, maybe for some people. A friend of mine just came back from East Germany, and he says there's a new joke in East Germany about the difference between an optimist and a pessimist. The pessimist looks at situation in the iron block countries and says, it can't get any worse. The optimist says, oh, yes, it can. In German, it's even more important. Schlimmer kann's nicht werden. And the other guy says, oh. Boom. They already, Monday, I gave you this Greek word, which is in the text, translated Jesus the Christ, who is the very likeness of God. But I thought you might even get a little more punch if you see that Paul is using kind of a technical Christian word. He is God's icon. You know, sort of like the statue, the figure, the carving that you could see, hear, feel, and touch to see what God is like. Or, you know, the original casting of what Christian deity is. God's icon, Jesus, who is this strange winning loser. Remember, the whole center of his business is the cross. That's where he both was total loser. You know, he lost everything. Even lost the God connection, remember? Or at least it sounded like it. He said, my God, why are you forsaking me? But that whole operation was God's operation, showing Jesus, or in Jesus, showing us what God is really like. Namely, that God is out there to die, to lay his life on the line for even folks like that, maybe like us, folks who are losers and then bitch about being losers and then bitch about other people being losers and having to work for losers and having to be married to losers and having kids for losers and having parents for losers and having pastors who are losers and pastors grind because they got parishioners who are losers. And he comes into that loser's world to be the biggest loser of all with us losers. And in that strange flip-flop, that strange, Luther called it Das glückliche Wechsel, that curious kind of exchange program, that we get to dump our crud on him,
And he says, do it, dump it, I want it. And then he says, yes, and I'm going to dump my goodies onto you. That's the epistle lesson coming up 2 weeks from now as we track on through 2 Corinthians 5. God made him to be sin for us, although he really didn't have any sin on his own, so that we might become the righteousness of God. Do you see this, the switch? Sin's on our side of the ledger, and Jesus says, here, put that, write that on my account, I'll sign for that. And then guess what, I'll transfer stuff from my account, the very righteousness of God, we'll put that on your account. And that's what's going on in the crucifixion, as God reconciled. Come back next week, we're going to use that text next week. So, God's icon likeness on the cross, the winning loser. Every place where I've got an underlining here, that underlining is the words taken right out of the text, if we ever get to it. God's glory in the face of Jesus Christ, the crucified one. Big good news. And I'm using the New Testament word prognosis. Here's another Greek word, prognosis and diagnosis. The New Testament uses that in its own language. Gnosis is a word for either knowledge or seeing. The visual and the knowing are together also in our language. You know, what happens when you finally catch on to something? What do you often say?
Now I see.
Or you get insight into something. You know, that doesn't mean your ophthalmic nerves get better, but, you know, something up here, you know, the light went on. That's another visual metaphor for knowing.
Okay, diagnosis is literally God seeing through us,
like an x-ray.
Prognosis is God seeing us through.
It's a pun in Greek too, diagnosis and prognosis. God seeing through us or God seeing us through. And of course that starts sounding like good news right off the bat. Okay, the big thing is what God is up to in Jesus Christ. And that's the way Paul talks about it in 2 Corinthians 4. But he says, guess what folks, it's even better than that. Because if you believe that, if you trust that, then you have that very treasure yourself, to be sure, still in your earthen vessel, in your, you know, this mortal human body. Doesn't look very, you know, not much. And he says, I look out at you, and I suspect you see the same as you look at me. You say, that's supposed to be a son of God? I don't see much sparkle, you know, a little flippant lip, but, you know, that's not very close to deity, I bet. At least not like Jesus. So better than that, all these goodies are now, if you will, poured in, vesseled into us, earthen though we are, and earthen is always the biblical word for mortal. You know, dust you were and back to dust you go. But both are true, that this treasure are earthen vessels. And now I've added another Greek word that I didn't pull out Monday night. It's in the text 3 times. Hyperbole. Paul says, we have this treasure in earthen vessels to show that the hyperbole power belongs to God. RSV just says transcendent, and that's flat compared to Paul's real word. Hyperbole means, you know, it just blows off the top, or just off the charts. Hyperbole literally means to throw it way over. And then later on in the text, he uses the word hyperbole twice. It says a treasure or something, no. A measure of glory beyond all comparison, somewhere that's in there. And in the Greek, that's, it's a hyperbole that blows all hyperboles. It's super, it's hyperbole. Okay. It's as though Paul's saying, you thought that was good, and you thought that this is good. Guess what? You know, it goes even higher than that. You can have hyperbole about your future when you're hooked into this. Because now you have this ministry, the ministry that, Paul's quoting Paul, that I, Christ's man, Christ's woman, because he repossessed me. But now he says, guess what, Ed? I don't want you to just sort of work for me here, you know, waiting on tables giving me stuff. I want you to be waiting on tables for those folks. That's where the job assignment is. So I'm your Lord, but you are their servant. You're their little me, their little Christ, to do for them what I did for you. And then he gets very explicit. He said, just in case you didn't catch what I'm talking about, twice over, he says, that means Jesus Christ does his dying and rising in your bodies. In our bodies, he's in the first person. And that when you get crucified on the job, at least Christians would say, I'm not just getting nailed by that SOB who's always out to get me, you know, the boss or the underling or whoever. But if Jesus is in the mix here somehow, and this is another mini crucifixion, And I'm encouraged by him to understand how this crucifixion that's going on in my body is a part of his repossession program. And I may have to do some thinking, you know, to compute that. I may have to wrap and talk with lots of other fellow Christians to see if that makes any sense to them or to see how they work it out. Or I may have to come 10:45 to a morning session like this and maybe we'll get, you know, nickels worth done on it. But that's at least the pointer. Let's start reading the Bible. Would you just begin 2 Corinthians chapter 4? Would you read verse 1 and then let's just start to go around each little table verse for verse until we get all the way through. And if you want to sort of be checking or reflecting, just see if any of this really does tie up with the text.
Is it verse 1?
Yes.
Okay. Therefore, having this ministry by the mercy of God, we do not lose heart.
We have renounced disgraceful, underhanded ways. We refuse to practice cunning or to tamper with God's word. But by the open statement of the truth, we would commend ourselves to every man's conscience in the sight of God.
And even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled only to those who are perishing.
In their case, the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the likeness of God.
For what we preach is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, with ourselves as your servants, for Jesus' sake.
Yeah, please.
For it is the God who said, let light shine out of darkness, who has shown in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ.
Yeah, Paul piles up a whole raft of them to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. There's about six of his big nouns for, you know, what the good news is.
But we have this treasure in earthen vessels to show that the transcendent power belongs to God and not to us.
The Greek word there is to show that the hyperbole power belongs to God and not to us.
We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed, perplexed, but not driven to despair.
Persecuted, but not forsaken, struck down, but not destroyed.
Notice that whole list of just those two verses is Paul kind of chronicling in his own body biography, how the dying and rising goes on. And he picks, you know, these pairs of opposite words, you know, a crucifixion word, but, you know, a resurrection word. You know, I got knocked down, but I still could get back up, blah, 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 blah. And then he says, just in case you Corinthians didn't catch what I was saying, I'll put it in simple words for you, which John will now read.
Always carrying in the body the death of Jesus so that the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our bodies.
For while we live, we are always being given up to death for Jesus' sake.
Note the always. Paul does not say once in a while, you know, you may have a kind of a crucifixion resurrection, and it may be, you know, painful. But he says this is the normal paradigm. This is the normal pattern. That every day is some kind of a on the cross and then back out of the tomb again. And then on the cross and tomorrow morning back out of the tomb again.
So that the life of Jesus may be manifest in our mortal flesh.
Comment on that one. The life of Jesus means that life can come from crucifixion. When he says life of Jesus, he's not just saying, finally get the crucifixion behind you and then just play Easter all the time, you know, role play the Easter thing. But the life of Jesus is always both. That life comes out of crucifixion. That resurrection comes out of being nailed to death. That, you know, both sides constitute what Jesus' crazy, unique way of living is. Which is, of course, clean contrary to what the God of this world said. The God of this world says, if you lose, you're a loser. And the New Testament all over says, if you do your losing together with Christ, you wind up being a winner. Remember the passage? He who seeks to save his life is guaranteed to lose it. But whoever loses her life for my sake together with me, they get it all back again. That the paradigm, well, my colleague, whose picture you'll see on those blurbs if you pick one up, Bob Bertram says, that little passage in the New Testament, it's in every one of the Gospels, so it's a big one, and it's repeated in a couple of the synoptics. Whoever seeks to gain her life will lose it. Whoever seeks to lose her life, myself, will gain it again, or win or lose. It says, especially in our day today, people talk about, oh, let's get away from win-lose situation. And above all, let's get away from lose-lose situation. But that word of our Lord says, in the human community, in human life after the fall, it's only lose-lose. But there are two different ways of losing. One is to lose while you try to hang on to it and save it for yourself. You know, which the God of this world, it's also in our heads, tells us, you know, you only go around once in this life, so grab for all the, what was it, Schlitz, gusto you can get. Yeah. Or variations on that. And that really is the God of Madison Avenue. Not because those people are wicked and demonic, but because that is the theology that makes sense to folks. They say, you know, you can't finally win the game, you're finally all going to die, so let's at least be winners until that day.
This way, or the other way of losing is to lose, comma, whoever loses her life for my sake in the gospel, comma, you know, will gain it back again. There's another clause yet that comes after that thing. So two ways of losing, lose period or lose comma. Continued reading. No comment.
All right.
What?
Because of our preaching, we face death, but it has resulted in eternal life for you. Now I've lost my place.
A school teacher who's lost her place. Talk about losers. Well, we need you here.
The word transcendent.
Okay.
But I'll read instead.
Oh, yeah, you're going to punish us now. I'll fix you. You don't want my stuff. You're out.
Then we have the same spirit of faith as he had who wrote, I believed and so I spoke. We too believe and so we speak. Knowing that he who raised the Lord Jesus will raise us also with Jesus and bring us to you, with you, into his presence.
See, related to the whole ball of wax as to how we live in our workplace and in our lives is our own perspective of where the heck we're going. You know, where's the future? What future am I heading for? And the world says if you're heading for a future that looks like you got a cross on it, or even just tomorrow, run the other way. And Paul says, well, you know, if you bumped into him and the good news that's in that strange story about this winning loser or this losing winner, then you also got a different, you're at least offered a completely different view about your future. Even just tomorrow, as well as the long-range future. That you could get crucified over and over again, and he says, he guarantees that I'll raise you up when it's all over. That it's going to be death, comma, and then life. Lose, comma, but then a winner. But that's then concrete. You probably can't see it from way back, but I put hyperbole about our future. Not just that, well, when it's all over, we'll make it. But as you'll see in the next couple of verses, he said, are we going to make it? You should see how we're going to make it by his guarantee. Let's just track on through to that yet.
For it is all for your sake, so that as grace extends to more and more people, it may increase thanksgiving to the glory of God.
Do we come up here to this one, Carolyn? Will you pick it up?
So we do not lose heart. Though our outer nature is wasting away, our inner nature is being renewed every day.
For this light momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison.
Because we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transcendent, but for the things that are unseen are eternal.
Okay, one could, and I've done it a little bit in my interjections here, you could almost read the whole text through again and just sort of, you know, let this kind of be the sieve or the prism with which you look at that. I'll just take you from verses 14 through 18, it's just my own notes, to see that how an awful lot of what Paul is saying here is already Paul at prognosis number 3, you know, just being autobiographically reflective as well as Christian servant-y helpful, or he thinks he's being helpful, to the Corinthians who are having a heck of a time to stay on this chart. You know, that chart over there is dominating. He doesn't say you guys aren't on this chart, but he says, you know, you guys are having trouble staying here, and you keep sliding back over there, you know, to the brown writing, and then you fall away from the green. 14, knowing that whoever it was that raised Jesus from the dead will do it again for us. That's part of the hyperbole. For daily life in our body. Or, and all this is for your sake, maybe that I don't, you know, it's not for my sake anymore, since I'm already in the new system, you know, the new repossession program, but it's for the sake of you folks who are either slipping out or never yet been in. The whole purpose of my Paul being in this mix is so that you'd be the beneficiaries. to expand the whole operation. That phrase about so that it would go to more and more people, and that they would increase in their thanksgiving. The Greek word, as we know, is Eucharist, their Eucharistia, and that God would get more glory, that God would get more jollies, that God would get more credit for pulling more of this stuff off in their lives as well. And so therefore, I don't lose heart, Paul says, even when I go through all these meat grinders. And the reason is not, you know, that I'm a masochist and I like to be hurt, or that I'm just dumb and don't know what's going on. But I got a completely different optic, you know, in my glass about reading what's going on. And the optic is basically P1, prognosis 1. Christ's death and resurrection is the new way of reading reality that comes out on top. So I do not lose heart. And so you might say, rather lose heart, you know, take heart, or be encouraged, or even be courageous. Even though there is loss, Paul says, the outer me, whatever he means by that, I suppose it's related to this bodily me, this mortal me, this Ed that you can see here, feel, and touch, and the Ed whom you can hurt, and the Ed who can hurt other people, even though that is indeed, you know, being chiseled away by lots of things, you know, doing its losing. Nevertheless, the other Ed, the other me, he calls it the inner me. He calls not a Gnostic or a Platonist, so you don't want to get that kind of stuff on him. That other me is the me that's connected to him. Also a very bodily one. You know, it's this guy, this biography, this history. That one, in a sense, grows with the crucifixion, resurrection metaphor. Strange as that sounds, dying and rising is the growth pattern for this earthen vesseled Ed, when that earthen vesseled Ed is hooked into the one who did it first and came out as death's conqueror. So when you contrast the stuff that's going on now, this is verse 17, for this slight momentary affliction, and when you read Paul's long list, you can say, well, either that's, you know, he's either tongue-in-cheeking that or he's fudging, but I think he's using the very, he said, this slight momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory that is the hyperbole beyond all hyperboles. That's what the Greek said. And so he's saying, when you really kind of put it in the balance of comparison, if you want to do that, and sometimes I do too, this really is peanuts. Although it may be 60 or 70 years of getting nailed all the time, it's peanuts compared to the Ed Schrader plus Jesus Christ future that is there, you know. Either way you measure it, just quantitatively, which probably isn't the best way, or qualitatively, especially qualitatively in the sense that a life that will last, that cannot be nailed anymore. And that must be some of what he means. We look to the things that are unseen, not seen. Since the things that are seen are momentary and flash, but the unseen things last forever. Can you get any, well, what sense do you make out of that? Let's just take a minute to talk on that. Paul talks about even looking for the unseen things. That's a contradiction in terms. He said, I want to go around and look for things that I'll never be able to see.
Call a wagon, Louis.
Take him away.
Do we have to give an example?
You don't have to do anything,
okay,
but you may.
Okay, reasons to tolerate oppression. And that would be unseen.
Okay.
Go on.
It must be something in that direction. You know, people can't see my connection with Jesus the Christ. When they see me dying, they say, well, that's dumb Ed Schrader. He got nailed again, and most of the time he deserved it. So once in a while, you know, maybe he really didn't. But all that's seen is, you know, just me and me, or me together with you. But the connection with Christ is, at least to that extent, not seeable. And it doesn't mean it's unreal. But the connection with Christ, the New Testament is full of this, takes the form of a promise. You know, promise and trust, promise and trust. That's why the marriage is a fundamental New Testament metaphor. Because what holds marriages together is not sex, but promise and trust. And if the promise and trust is gone, usually then the marriage is gone. Even if the sex continues, or even if the sex can't be there, but the promise and trust can still be there. And promise and trust are technically not seen. You know, you can't put your hand on it and say, there's promise. And sure enough, there's trust. But that doesn't mean they aren't operational and aren't real. And Paul says that's what, in this You know, that's what we keep our eyes focused on. The Greek word here is scopeo, which means that's what we're scoping. Isn't that a word these days? But what does scoping mean today, Fred, as folks use it?
It's a little new to my rhetoric. It's planning what you're going to do.
Oh, well, that's good.
Pre-step to actually doing
it. Oh, well, then we ought to put scoping in here, because the Greek word is there. Paul says we scope not the things that are seen, but we're scoping the unseen turf as we, if you will, head for our future. Excuse me, you were going to say something, Carol, and
I cut
you off.
No, I was just going to say that that's how what faith is to me.
All right.
The unseen.
Yeah, you can see faithful people functioning, but you can't see the faith itself. Because faith is, what's she hanging her heart on? And even that's a metaphor, you know, literally you don't take, you know, your cardiac muscle and say, I'm going to hang it over there.
Isn't it partly looking within, looking to inner, we talk about inner strength, you know, those are both part of the unseen things. You don't see them with the eye, with vision. We see them. Why don't we talk more about the God spirit within instead of talking about the God spirit without? We always have to reach out here. The power always comes from out here down. Or, I don't know, from out here over or wherever, but it doesn't matter from what place.
Why is that unhappy or unsatisfactory for you?
Because it's like reaching out that you have to get something from here. Why don't we talk about the God spirit that's within us?
Well, because it's not Christian. That's one reason.
Why?
Because you've been able to make your little speech right now without ever mentioning the name. And that doesn't mean, no, okay, say Jesus, and that's okay.
Oh, wait a minute. Now, if you talk about the Trinity, I mean, you have to...
No, I'm not talking about the Trinity.
The Holy Spirit, or
I'm saying, why do you need a crucified and risen Messiah? That's you know, that's one way of forming the nitty-gritty question. Paul says the reason people need a crucified and risen Messiah is operating with the God Spirit that's within them, they operate themselves right onto death. No God Spirit that Paul had ever run into had ever gotten anyone that ever licked death for anybody. Now you may say, well, okay, that's their hangout. Death isn't my hangout. And Paul said, well, okay, hope you make it. This is an important tangent, but I'm going to bracket it now just so we can get back and try to do a little bit of what we were going to do. Well, we've done a lot, but I want to at least do a little bit of crossing. We've only got 15 minutes for those of you, or 20 minutes for those of you who split for the first session. Fred, would you come up here, there's a chair here, and just sort of walk us through your sheet here again, give us another little more is that yours? Or whichever side, okay. Tell us a little bit about your work. And what we want to do, in the quarter hour so we've got left, is just to do a trial one with Fred crossing him. Now you all have got your sheets in front of you, if you already see places where things from this page of diagnostic material or this page of prognostic material has a crossover to your own page, you know, unfold it and scribble down something just so you get it. For example, is there something in your work life and your life on the job and the way you react to it that signals anything of this kind of diagnostic fact? Either being a loser or have to work with loser or being disheartened or whatever. Is it even deeper than that? That the God of this world has got you conned, and somehow that factors in, even if it's kind of difficult to sift out. And is it even worse than that? That on your work life and in your job, some of what Paul's talking about here is also surfacing, or at least, you know, reaching in and getting at you. And then by the same token, over there, since you're all, I gather, folks who think of themselves or who have entrusted themselves to the Christ and some way that's meaningful or helpful for you, or at least it used to be, even if now you may be on a rocky road. Do you see places where sort of the pluses over there also have crossover connections to some of the things in your life? Either because some of these things are already happening and that kind of, you know, gives you an aha to sort of see them better, or because some of the things ain't happening, and sure enough, if you could get a little of that green stuff over onto your brown sheet, you know, you'd have something better than you didn't have before. That in effect is all that the crossing operation is. It's not easy, but that's what the process is. Now Fred's going to just kind of give us a sort of track himself out loud a little for us again, and then I'm going to ask Fred himself to start seeing if there's anything from this page or that page that you see crossing, And then all the rest of us join in from what we've heard him say to see if we can help him some more.
Okay. I work at the University of Washington, and my job is community affairs coordinator, and that means the university with 34,000 students and 2,000 faculty and about 10,000 staff is almost 50,000 people. We make a large impact in the city of Seattle and on the neighborhoods where we're located. My job is to be a liaison person with the city government, and also with the neighborhoods and existing community groups and individuals around this large bureaucracy, the large institution, to tell them what's being planned, what's happening, to interpret the institution to them, and to hear their usually criticism, some of their concerns, be able to tell them what they can do about it, who they can talk to, and also communicate community concerns back to the institution, hopefully to make it a large organization more responsive to the setting, to the environment where it's located. Usually this has to do with a number of community meetings, going to a lot of meetings, dealing with things primarily that people don't like that the institution's doing.
Can you give us a for instance, let's say in the last week or last month, a couple examples.
We're increasing our hospital by 150 beds. It's in an area that's badly congested. There's one of the arterials that leads into the university across a bridge. Is that the peak hour in the afternoon goes from 1 o'clock until 6 o'clock. It's really at capacity most of that time. We're going to be adding people to that by this addition to the hospital. Both staff and patients, families that will be visiting patients, and people who live in those neighborhoods where the traffic is already intolerable see this as just another, increasing, maybe adding another half hour onto what's already an intolerable situation.
So what did you do on the job with reference to that?
I told them what the plans were initially, before, as early in the process as possible, what steps there were when there would be meetings and hearings, who they could write to, who they could contact, if they had wanted to schedule meetings, and I would bring people from the university out to talk about the problems that we were creating by what we were doing and what we could do as an institution to at least mitigate those problems.
By the way, any of you want to interrogate Fred, this is open season now. If you ask him a question, then he won't just look at me.
Yeah.
I'm embarrassed. Okay, go on.
Okay. That's a large part of what I do. It isn't all that I do. And I do some things internally within the university to sensitize people in a large bureaucracy to what those outside concerns are that they may not be aware of or may not want to be aware of.
If we put one word down for your job description, is it mediator?
Communicator.
That's too flat.
Negotiate, actually, or do you just
peacemaker? Are you a peacemaker?
No.
If people come to you with problems, you're not...
I don't
just give them information, you say, that's information, kids, you're stuck with it?
No.
No, I didn't think so.
Partly it's educator.
All right.
I say this is how this institution's working, this is how it functions, and if you really want to make some kind of dent in it, this is how you do it.
You tell them that you can dent this 50,000 member bureaucracy, right?
That's
right.
I bet you do. Sure I do.
Like what? Give me a for instance.
Well,
that's real. That's real.
Okay. If you don't get satisfaction in dealing with the institution, you can have more leverage if you working through city government, because they have to issue the building permits, they give approval, you know, that they have leverage.
But Fred, what you're telling me is I can fight one bureaucracy if I can hack my way through another bureaucracy. And I've always lost the city hall. What the hell are you talking about?
I guess we've got a city government right now that's more responsive than most, I think.
Well,
so I say, here are some channels where you can go And ultimately, we get our money from the state legislature. And if you don't find satisfaction anyplace else down the line, work through the legislature. And here's who you can contact.
Have you seen that process ever work?
Yeah.
It does work.
Yeah, I guess it's worked in terms of compromise. The people who are complaining get something that more than they would have gotten. We get something as an institution less than what we originally intended to do. Maybe nobody's totally satisfied, but it's better than what would have come out otherwise.
That's the Kissinger principle of negotiation, literally.
Yeah.
That nobody gets everything of what they wanted, but everybody gets something of what they wanted, and everybody loses a little something.
Do the people feel like you're just passing the buck?
No.
Fred, what do you get?
He gets it in the back.
I want to know from Fred.
What do I get? I get some personal pleasure out of dealing with some sticky problems and helping people see what they feel is an impossible task, helping to see that there's some things that they can actually do.
You always work with sticky problems all the time.
The sticky problems are the ones that nobody's interested in. The ones that aren't sticky, really. Occasionally we'll get support as an institution for something we're doing. We built some student housing, and by and large we had support from most segments of the community on that.
Our all problems are sticky, it just depends on the degree of stickiness.
Sure. Mm-hmm. I like the controversy in some ways, and it's not where there's hostility, it's not directed at me as an individual, but at an institution, and sometimes by understanding how that institution works and how you can really where you can be heard, at least heard, and there's satisfaction. People say, "Aha! There is something I can do. I don't feel as helpless as I did before."
But you're saying the worst thing about your job is that you question the real guy. An hour from then, a year from then, what difference is it going to make?
Yeah, I put 10 years from now. What difference does it make?
We've only got 10 minutes. Yeah. I'm going to interject here because, you know, it's a sticky wicket. It's a sticky problem.
Yeah.
But Fred, would you at least take us through the sheet and give us a little of your proposal where you see some crossings to the white papers on either side?
Well, I like the... I've got a great deal of flexibility to do my job in the way I see fit. And I can be creative and I can... there's a lot of room for innovation. There's also a lot of flexibility in hours and time, and I like that. I question the long-term value of what I'm doing. And even the people that I may be talking with who learn something more that may help them, but they're only interested in that one thing that for them is a crisis. And maybe they learn something about how you impact and change a university and get something of what you want from the institution. But next time it'll be somebody else. And is it really, 10 years from now, 5 years from now, 3 years from now, what can I point to and say, hey, that's really an accomplishment that I feel has helped? And I guess there has to be some, for me, I want to see some kind of tangible results. I'd love to be a cabinet maker. There it is. You can see it. Everybody agrees that's a beautiful piece of furniture. You made it.
And it will last forever?
It will last much longer than...
forever.
No, not forever.
So it sounds like you don't get a whole lot of strokes.
I get quite a few strokes, but it has to do with short-term kinds of things. I get strokes for how I do what I do.
Who do you get them from?
Both. I get them a lot from the community people that I meet with, and I get some from people within the institution, too.
What
enough.
Happens when you find yourself being more of an advocate for the community than for the university? And I would suspect this happens sometimes.
I generally not.
You not?
Because I work both ways,
and
I'm working with the community, I say, here's how the institution works, and here's how you can... do something about it. And when I'm talking to people in the administration, I say, here's what the community thinks, and here's what's happening, and they're going to come to you, and it's between you two now.
Uh-huh.
But when you lay it on the line like that, yeah. You have to say, this is what the community is thinking. What is the response of your colleagues? Do they question the value of what you do?
Sure. Or they question the value. They may say they're nuts, you know. And I say you can tell them.
They don't kill the messenger, though.
No. That's why I said I think I'm an educator.
Okay. Can you move? We got a few minutes. Do you see any of Paul's diagnostic stuff or his prognostic stuff initially impacting your work?
I guess there's one other thing that a lot of what I'm doing doesn't reflect sort of a I'm not doing something that I'm saying that's clearly me. I'm saying I'd like to do something that in some ways I'd like to do a job that says this is my product, this is something I'm doing almost alone.
What you're doing now is not really Fred.
Yeah.
It's not the real Fred. That's not really you. Partly could be a calling for you.
Oh, I think it's where I'm called to at the moment. I'm not sure it's where I'm called to stay.
Okay. Are you bugged by it anyway, D1, D2, D3? Fred on the job.
Yeah, I think I lose heart. I think I feel like I'm doing the same thing over and over, and what it's almost like plugging holes in the dike sometimes. And that losing heart and feeling kind of like this is just a stopgap. It may be important at the moment, but it's only, you know, the institution is going to keep growing. People are going to be dissatisfied. And in some ways I feel like a loser in that I'm just plugging holes. And there are new holes that are going to keep popping up. And I identify with that.
Is the God of this world conning you in that very term?
In some ways, I think that, yeah, that by saying like this becomes like the plugging the holes becomes an end in itself, and I think there must be something more beyond that.
You think so?
I believe there is more than that.
Well, if you're depending on which God you're listening to,
yeah.
Does the God of this world say plugging holes is relatively unimportant work, do you think?
No, I think he says that's the most important and only thing that, you know, keep doing it. Keep doing it better. Keep doing it more.
Why? What for? What does the God of this world give as a rationale for that? Keep plugging those holes. Plug those holes. Plug those holes.
You do it so well. Just keep doing it. And sometimes I think it's good when I'm not, you know, it's like getting so locked into the immediate task that I don't say what in the long run could be.
It's real flattering.
It maintains the system too.
Yeah, that's.
Well, would the God on the other sheet over there, the crucified God, ever say, "Fred, keep plugging those holes. You do it so well."
No.
Would not.
But why wouldn't
I? Well, the rest of you agree with that?
No.
Okay.
I disagree.
Explain it to him, Gloria.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, the God of this world, to me, would say, do it because it's a good job. You may get some more money, maybe. I mean,
secure.
But it's secure, yeah. You can buy stuff with all the money you get from doing this job.
Well, I'm not the getting God, all that much for
it. But the God, our God, says that is a gift you have to communicate with people. And use my gifts wisely that I give you. And you are good at it, and so
and
that's
people get,
why.
People do get help, even
people
if they
get
just
help.
Get little
yeah.
helps. But
even
you said you open windows of hope for them, or help that they thought
yeah.
they didn't even have.
And I think if you
important.
Do something well, I think that in itself can be ministry, because people can look at you and you're doing, you're working in a secular world, you're doing well, and yet you have an opportunity to share, you know, this, you know, the good news.
Yeah, but sometimes aren't you ripping off the people in the community, tearing up playgrounds?
Oh, I feel like what I'm doing is pretty clean, that I'm saying this is what's happening and these are the reasons, and you may legitimately not like it, but I want you to know what's happening and what the rationale is behind
it. And the benefits overall.
I think this God may be saying, you've got some skills that have been really honed and developed that should be used in a way that might be more long, bring some more long-term benefit to people.
Hospital is a long-term thing. It's a very long-term thing.
Well, what is the attraction for you, the pull of that word long-term? You've used it about 6 times now in the last 20 minutes. Why is that the, what's the plus component of that for you? And its opposite then would be negative, short-term.
Well, I think what I'm doing is educational, and I'm educating on one-shot basis around one issue with people that maybe, to me, long-term is the kind of working more with the same people over a longer period of time so that they then, that I can see some growth and change in them as a result of that.
Did Jesus have a long-term work career? I mean, did he achieve long-term goals or short-term goals in the biography we've got of his working life?